You are now listening to The Social Hour.
They're not PC, so if occasional foul language turns you off, then you have all been warned. This is the calm before the storm.
I'm Mexican with a GED. What do you want from me?
Get ready for the social hour.
Live from Dice World Studios in San Antonio, Texas, this is The Social Hour. On today's show, absolute Wonder Woman writer and creator of Jeff the Land Shark, comic book creator Kelly Thompson. And now your host. He doesn't need Wonder Woman's lasso of truth to admit that she's writing his favorite monthly comic book, Deese Casillas.
Mullum Keen, everyone. Welcome to the show. This is The Social Hour. I am Deese. Thanks for coming back for another episode, guys. We appreciate you hanging out as always. If you like what you hear, tell a friend, let someone know, rate us on your favorite podcast listening device, whatever you're listening to a podcast on these days. I don't know, you can get a podcast on a kumquat, I assume, these days. It's crazy out there. But real quickly, guys, just a couple announcements before we get into it with our guest today. I've got some live dates coming up. I will be at the Hayden Lounge in San Antonio on this Saturday, the 7th, and Bourbon and Branch in Spring Branch, Texas on the 11th. And I will be back in San Antonio Artisan on the 14th, Artisan Distillery, I think that's right, on the 14th. And then the Hilarious Comedy Show is coming back to Upstage Comedy Lounge, our favorite monthly show at our favorite comedy club in Texas, on the 22nd. Get your tickets to that. Tickets are going fast. Use my promo code HAPPY for our sponsor this month, Happy Chameleon, if you want to get half off your tickets to that. Also, guys, go to inferno.earth and check out everything going on. We've got some new merch going up on the site. And also, we just re-upped all covers for Killstand number 2. So you can get those variants. They are available. But, man, they're going fast. We've got some limited options up there. And, we've got our shop set up. You can just order directly from the website now. You don't even have to hit me up on Messenger. You can just go to the shop and do technology stuff, because that's better. And that's it, guys. You know what to do. Check out Deese Comedy for all the comedy stuff. Go to inferno.earth for the comic book stuff. And that's it for the announcements. We are going to get into it with our guest. She is a comic book writer, among many other things. Currently writes the best monthly comic book going, in my opinion. And I'm happy to have her here. Please welcome to the show Kelly Thompson. Kelly, how are you?
Hi, I'm well. Thank you so much. That's a hell of a bar to set, best comic book going. I appreciate it.
It, in my opinion, and I've been reading comic books for how amount of years.
You got a few short boxes behind you.
They keep going. Oh. It keeps going. There's like about 35,000 comic books in this room. For my money, in my opinion, Absolute Wonder Woman is the best monthly comic book going right now.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, really. I have a lot of questions about it and things I want to talk about in general with you. But first of all, I always ask a random question to my guests up front. So for you, Kelly Thompson, do you believe in aliens?
Yes. I don't know that I believe like little green, gray, whatever, Area 51 necessarily. Like, I'm not fully in on that necessarily, but I'm very of the contact. It's a hell of a lot of space. It's sure. Ridiculous to think we're the only thing out here. So
statistics, right?
Also, I'm a big sci-fi nerd. I mean, you know, The Expanse is one of my favorite television shows of all time, which is like, you know, all about all the crazy shit you can find out there. How much of that is belief and how much of that is just like the worlds you trade in and wanting to believe in those potentials, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing you said is like the most realistic, where it's like just statistically speaking, yeah. You know, numbers wise, it seems impossible. And if so, like I forget who it was. There's some philosopher said, I don't know what a scarier proposition is, the thing that the idea that we are not alone in this universe or the idea that we are, you know?
I mean, I think the latter is scarier for sure. I mean, as fallible, vulnerable, idiot human beings, it's scary to think of either equally stupid other races out there just trying to destroy everything they come into contact with and being so goddamn stupid. I'm not feeling great about humanity lately, clearly.
Sure.
But let's move on. You know, I think the funny thing is, you know, sci-fi trends so much in aliens coming here, and that's usually a negative thing. But I tend to think if you can get here, probably you're pretty advanced, and we'd probably benefit from that. I mean, yeah, sure. Do they want to come and like harvest all the water out of our bodies and like desiccate our planet and move on? Sure, it's possible.
Yeah.
But it's also possible that if you're, you know, I was reading something. It's terrible that I can't tell you what it was. I'm sure it was some bullshit on the internet, but that was talking about how it's crazy when a big budget sci-fi movie wants to talk about people come, like aliens coming here and taking our water or something, because of all the water that's in space. Like you would be a fool.
Yeah.
You'd be a fool to come to Earth to be like, oh, let's take these oceans. We'd be like, hey, let's just drag this giant, ice asteroid back to wherever we need to go, you know. So anyway, I think the possibilities are sort of endless. Of course, some of them are scary, but yeah, I think the loneliness is more scary, especially because to me, I don't really believe at all that it could be that there's nothing out there. So if there's nothing that we can find out there, that just honestly just suggests to me that there's more of our kind of situation out there where you destroy yourself before you manage to destroy other galaxies.
I don't know. Yeah. Which, you know,
I don't know how you could even be like a Star Wars fan, like one of the biggest fandoms in all the world. How could you even be a Star Wars fan and not believe there's more? I mean, you know,
I think the people that don't believe are lying to themselves to make themselves feel better, you know? Because, like, I think deep down you have to, I mean, if you start thinking about it, there's no way that it doesn't make sense. That, like, so if you, like, stick your finger up in the night sky, just the tip of one of your fingers covers, like, 10,000 of our galaxies, right?
That's crazy.
So, so then extrapolate that by the rest of the goddamn sky. And then, you're like, so you're going to tell me in all of that, there's zero chance that there's anything. And it's, you know, I mean, and we're so hubristic that we assume it's going to look like us in some way, whether even if it's bipedal or like, you know, have arms and legs. Like, we don't, there could be elements out there that we don't have on this earth that create a whole other type of life that we can't even comprehend.
I think probably the big part of the equation we're sort of leaving out of this, as we talk about it as sort of sci-fi and fantasy type nerds who love those kind of stories, probably religion is probably a big factor for people who don't believe. I'm sure there are people who believe in aliens who also, I mean, I'm not up on what all the religions, how they track that, but you know, I'm like a kid who famously was gonna join the Presbyterian church when I was really little, and I had a lot of concerns, and we're talking about, like, I think I was 8. the pastor like came over. I mean, maybe they do that for all before you're gonna like be baptized into the church or whatever. Maybe they always do that meeting before, but he had to come to the house, and I remember sitting with him in the very formal living room and asking him questions. And one of my big questions was, I go to school and I'm learning about evolution and the dinosaurs, and I don't understand how these things track. And you know, I think so I left religion behind I don't know, probably in that living room. I mean, I played at it for a long time. I tried to do it, and then I didn't really, like, leave the church and be like, I'm not doing this until I was, like, 15 or something.
Sure.
But I suspect that's probably a big blind spot for me and maybe you about how people feel about that. It's probably driven for a lot of people since this whole planet is pretty religious. That's probably a factor I'm pretty blind to. So.
Yeah. I would imagine that's the biggest, the biggest thing. But I mean, I still think even those people are coming from a family who is, I have a similar situation, kind of like we were raised Catholic and then my family converted to Baptist later in life. And like my brother is a Baptist preacher. My sister works at a Baptist school and
her husband
in like a religious school. And, I do stand-up comedy for a living.
Yeah, so you can probably imagine
which one of us, my parents, is more smoke. Yeah, like one of us gets a call on our birthday, the other one of us doesn't. I still think that those people have, you can say cognitive dissonance or faith or whatever, but I mean, I think people can lie outwardly, but I don't know how much they can lie inwardly. Like, I think at a certain point when they're alone at night with their swimming in their thoughts, I think that's, I think they're still like, oh man, there's some shit out there probably,
Well, I think that they're probably, I just am uneducated in this area. I'm sure there are religions and faiths and ways of approaching this where they're like, yes, you can believe in these things. God created this universe. And I don't know what it is. In fact, to give that pastor credit from all those many years ago in my living room, he didn't say, well, dinosaurs are bullshit or evolution is bullshit or whatever. He said something that was like trying to bridge it, that it's okay to believe both these things. God could have created the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, but then how does the history work? And he's like, well, he was saying things like, well, just because we have this book doesn't mean we understand everything in it. And that's actually a great bit from The Expanse. I assume it's in the books because it's such a great bit, but I haven't read the books. I've only watched the show. Don't at me, anyone. She says something about, that God left two texts. It's the world if they contradict each other, it's perhaps that we don't understand one yet.
Mm.
And I think that's a pretty good approach that allows you to be like, I believe in this thing and I believe in this other thing and they seem like they don't go together, but perhaps I just don't understand them yet, or the world doesn't know enough to understand them yet. Right. Like, I think the unknown is a great equalizer, right?
Yeah. Well, that's so true when it comes to anything. Cause I mean, that's why I approach everything in life with agnosticism, really, because it's like, I'm a fucking idiot. What do I know? And there's way more that's happened that I don't know about. And even like, the history we do know, how much of that is real or accurate or was, represented to us in a fair and, a transparent matter, probably very little of it,
It's not a particularly rewarding thing to feel or to think about, but I tend to think that people who haven't realized how little they know, like you're finally ahead of the game when you look at it and go, oh my God, I'm an idiot.
Yeah.
Like, I don't, you know what I mean? Like that, because that finally allows you to step back and be like, okay, I got a lot to learn. I got to open myself up to all this stuff I don't know, all this stuff that I assumed I knew and that I don't really know. Now we see. So I think, I felt like I had that epiphany really late in life. It was when I was like 26 and I was living in LA and I started reading an author that just completely blew my mind and changed my whole life. And it wasn't so much that writer specifically, it was the realization of all I didn't know.
Yeah.
And that allowed me to finally be like, okay, I guess I got a lot of work to do. And this is a whole process. And that was like that click over from being a stupid kid who sort of thought I knew everything to recognizing I don't know anything. But, you know, I go through life all the time with people who haven't had that.
Oh, yeah.
That click. And so even though I felt like it came quite late for me, I've always felt like I'm a slow learner and a slow grower and a slow to epiphany. You know, I come across people all the time who have never gotten that. So
yeah,
I'm grateful now that it came at 26.
Yeah, at least it came at all.
I used to kick myself like, my God, you're so slow at getting this.
Well,
now I'm like, that 50-year-old guy has not had that moment yet.
Yeah, you're doing all right. He has still strong opinions about separate water fountains. I think I'm doing okay. Yeah, like, I don't think that's that late in life, though, because, I mean, I think we just are, you know, by nature, we look back and think about, like, missed opportunities because of just the way linear time works for humans, you know?
Yeah.
So we look back and be like, oh, I should have, you know, shoulda, coulda, woulda, but it's like, oh, you know, that's really, you know, mid late 20s. It's like, that's kind of when you're becoming a person, really, most people. So, I mean, sure, we do a lot of stuff before that, but I mean, my God,
yeah.
I don't know how much of that stuff I want to recount.
Yeah.
I think statute of limitations might not allow me to on a lot of it.
I do think when it looks less bad when you're looking back on it. Like when I was 26 and it was happening, I was like, oh my God, I've wasted all this time.
Yeah.
And now I'm an idiot and I have so much to do. But like, you look back at it now and you're like, yeah, okay, I didn't know anything. I was 26.
Yeah.
I really was struggling. So it's not so bad.
Well, and that's the weird thing with time too, is like, as you get older, the amount of time something did or didn't happen becomes less of the total overall aggregate, you know what I'm saying?
So it
becomes less impactful, you know. It's a weird, you know.
The per capita.
Right, exactly. Down. Yeah, yeah. It's like a weird phenomenon with life, but let's talk about your journey to what you do now. I mean, how, you know, growing up, where'd you grow up, and like, how was your journey to getting into comic books? Were you a comic book fan, or how, what was your entry point into that medium?
So my first experience with comics were Archie comics, like Digest.
Mm-hmm.
But I got those from the grocery store, like the checkout one. It wasn't even from a spinner rack that had other comics on it. So I'm incredibly grateful to Archie's. Like, it's impossible to quantify my love for them when I was little. I truly like hoovered them up like crazy. I mean, I was a big reader from the earliest days, but it was later in life. Yeah. So I just think my love of Archie's, I didn't recognize as anything unique or even interesting. But I think when I look back on it now, my obsession with them was clearly about the form and about discovering a medium that I really, you know, like, you're a kid, you don't know about medium. You just know you're loving a thing. So, you know, I remember I went to, I had this rich friend's house, Jessica, and she had like horses and shit.
Sounds
and
like
we
rich,
went over there.
Name.
Yeah. And in her, in the upstairs bathroom, they had this massive basket that was just filled with Archie Digests, most of which I had not read. And so I became the worst friend ever because I just wanted to hang out and read those all. She's like, yeah, but I've already read those. Those are mine. I'm like, well, now I need to read them.
Yeah.
Like, I just, you know, so I think that, and she did not invite me. I mean, we still stayed friends, but like, yeah, she didn't invite me. Of course she didn't invite me over. She didn't want me to just watch me read her Archie Digest. So I was obsessed with them, and they were really important. I didn't realize how important they were until later, I think, but it made discovering the whole world of comics later made a lot more sense, I think, because I'd had that primer early on.
Yeah.
So it was, for me, it was when I was a teenager, a young teenager, when the X-Men animated show was on. I, like many people of a certain age, I discovered that and I was like, what is this? This is so great. And then a couple weeks later, my brother came home, or I think it was a couple weeks later. I have no actual idea. But in my mind, a few weeks later, he came home with copy of Uncanny X-Men 290, which had Storm on the cover, and he was like, it's the girl from the show! And I was like, oh my god, and that was it. And that was... I read comics every week. I have a hold. I understand, like, the whole world of it, as opposed to just, hey, these are these cool books I get at the grocery store.
Yeah.
So that was sort of my journey. I had really always wanted to be a writer. It's one of my earliest memories, writing and wanting to write. And I wrote these little mermaid books when I was a kid that, you know, I have a very clear memory of, like, very little. So I sort of always wanted to do that. I didn't really know what that looked like other than maybe I write books. I'm a novelist, maybe.
Yeah.
And it was when I rediscovered comics that I was like, oh, it's this.
Yeah, this is the thing. Very young, early teens, you were like, this, I want to write comic books. You were.
Yeah. And I could draw a little bit. So I also wanted to draw comics. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's interesting when you fall in love with that and you think that's a thing you want to dream to do. The writing and the art is inextricably linked for you.
Yeah.
Like, whether you understand that, oh, there's a writer and oh, there's an artist or not, for you, if you can only do one of those things, then you can only do half the story.
Right.
And so I was drawing also, but my drawing was not great. And I did eventually start just writing scripts and leaving behind, I mean, I was still doing character design and creating new characters and all that stuff, but I became more and more focused on scripts as I went. I think just recognizing I was better at one than the other.
Yeah.
I don't want to say I couldn't have become a good artist with enough time and attention and patience and training. I think talent and ability is a very real thing, but I also think you don't get there without putting in the work. If I had put in the work, perhaps something would have come of it. But I think I just recognized at some point that I would be better suited putting in the work on something else. I was never going to be as good as I wanted to be at art, you know?
Well, I think there's very, very few really good artist writers in the industry. Like, there's some, I mean, don't get me wrong, you know, like Walt Simonson had a great run at it, Frank Miller, you know, I mean, some things like that, but, like, you know, I mean, like Bendis was broken drawing his own stuff. And, you know, when you end up being like, when an editor finally tells you, like, hey, just write, and he starts writing and he becomes an even better writer, you know, like you become because you're splitting your time trying to do these two things instead of just being like a killer writer, you know, or like a killer artist.
I just think Bendis is a great example because Bendis's art is good and all that stuff he did is really fun and interesting, but it feels like him suddenly recognizing, wait, if I can write a good enough script, I can have any artist I want to do something way better than what I could do. And he also probably discovered, as anyone who writes something and then has someone way more talented than you fill up your email box, or maybe if you go far enough back, your mailbox with just incredible art, like Christmas time. Like, wait, this person took this thing I did and turned it into this amazing thing. Like, it feels like winning the lottery. It's an incredible feeling. So I think he probably clocked onto that. I'm not willing to come with you on the, there aren't a lot of great, great writer artists, because I think most cartoonists are writer artists, like the Kate Beatons of the world. And,
oh, I guess you that, know, yeah, so, yeah. So I guess I meant like and, mainstream comic books, but, like a lot.
But I think you hit the perfect example in Bendis, which is we don't see that a lot. Someone who's a really great writer who also can draw at a level that we're all like, holy crap. Like, you either get people who are sort of organically doing their own thing that's a writing and artist, or you get really great cartoonists who also can be great writers. I think Sophie Campbell is a great example of that. Like, you know, to my eternal frustration, Sophie Campbell is a great writer. She doesn't need me. You know, I would love her to have to draw all sorts of things that I can imagine, but she doesn't have to because she can draw whatever she wants. And she occasionally deigns to draw things that I want.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there are tons of examples that are in like that Sophie category, but you're right. The Bendis is one of the most famous examples ever, especially because, you know, who it's hard to name people who have done the writing thing in comics better than Bendis. So
yeah,
it's a great argument for being smart about, you know, trying things, being open to it, getting your work out there any way you can, but also recognizing where your interests are best served.
Yeah, where your strengths are and what's going to be best for your career. I mean, you know, like, not to name names, but you can look back at like early Image stuff and you're like, okay, like really great art, but not a lot of fluff in between those pages, in between really cool art, you know? So, you have guys that are like, hey, if you get a really good writer, your art is going to be amazing. But if you want to also write this, it's probably going to just be cool stuff to look at.
Yeah.
You know, so, but yeah, you know, there are great examples of people who can do both, but man, if you can figure out where you're best at and really like, especially if it comes a little easier to you, like in this case, it sounds like writing did, and just be like, I'm going to do that. Then you become, you know, elite writer in the industry. Yeah. So
I think there's also just a thing, you know, that in this case it helped me, which is great, because it often does not help me, which is that I'm very competitive. And one of the ways in which I committed to a path of trying something different was, I have this story I tell, I'll tell it quickly because I'm sure anyone who's listened to me talk before has probably heard this story. But when I was in college, I was studying graphic design and I was really enjoying it. I liked it. I was good at it. I thought it was very cool. I could see a career being a graphic designer. Like, I was like, okay, this is it. And I was taking the local comic shop had a zine that they did, and that guy sometimes ran a class, a sequential art class. So I took a night class with his sequential art, and it was very hard, and I produced terrible work, and I loved it. It was so fun. And around the same time that was happening, we had a graphic design class where I really liked the assignment, and there was an extra credit element. And I was like, oh, I love this assignment. I'm going to do the extra credit. And I did it, and I went to class, and every single fucking person did the extra credit. And I went home, and my project did well. I got a good grade. It was fun. But I went home, and I was like, holy shit, I'm never going to be great at graphic design. I'm never going to be the best. Because when these people go home, they're still thinking about graphic design, and I'm thinking about comic books. And if I want to be great at something, I need to be, the thing I go to work is the thing I'm still thinking about when I come home.
Yeah.
And that's comics. And I mean, I was still thinking about drawing then. I mean, I was in art school. I was taking art studies at a university, and I was considering transferring to the Savannah College of Art and Design. So I wasn't entirely yet giving up on the art part of that. I didn't know what it was going to look like for me, but I just knew I was in the wrong field.
Yeah.
And it hit like a bang. And I was like, it was like a giant neon sign on the road going, you must exit. You are on the wrong path. And I've been so grateful for that, especially because I talked to someone like, you know, my brother, who is the best of all the Thompsons. I have no trouble saying it. I think everyone would agree if we had to vote on who's the best person in the family. It's Dave. He's the best.
Dave
he's
Thompson.
The best.
We've all heard about Dave.
Dave Thompson. He's the best. But, you know, Dave has a stupid career that is not particularly fulfilling. It's not particularly financially fulfilling. And we've talked a few times about how he's very envious that I sort of had things I was passionate about, and also got, you know, because he knows the story about the neon sign blinking to get me off the road. I dropped out of college. I mean, I didn't drop out. I finished my year and then I transferred to another college, but I left. I left my whole college and everything, which I'm a very, like, I don't want to say conservative because I'm not conservative, but I'm a very risk averse, boring person. And so to change my whole life and move to the South of all places, not somewhere I really wanted to live, although Georgia turned out to be very beautiful and I had a great time. You know, there was tons of things I did not want to do at like 20 years old. And I was like, nope, the world is telling me this is wrong. And I got to change this right now. The longer I stay here, the harder it is going to be to get out of this. And he's very jealous that I had those moments. And so I'm very grateful for them, and I'm very aware that not everybody gets them. So.
Well, good for you for listening to that, because most people don't listen because, you know, they have this like societal norms of structure and why, well, I go to college and I do this and I don't like the job that much, but it pays well. And like, I mean, there's, have you ever seen the movie, Curious Case of Benjamin Buttons?
Mm-hmm.
So I love that movie. And there's this monologue at the end of that Brad Pitt's character is doing as like, he's getting younger and experiencing life more. And the girl he loved is getting older and they've kind of separated and gone their ways. And I'm going to paraphrase, but he basically is saying like, it's never too late to pivot, change, move, change who you are, be a different person, be who you want to be. And like, I just always loved that because, man, it really is never is. I mean, you know, like I've had friends who, you know, in their late 30s are like, oh man, if I went to college and did this, like in 4 years, I can start making this much money and do this thing I want to do. I'm like, do it. I go, think about what we were doing 4 years ago. It doesn't seem that long ago, right? Great. Well, in 4 years, it'll be done and you'll be doing the thing you want to do instead of just, you know, milling through life with this like low grade depression.
It's very, I've said very many times, the object of rest stays at rest. Like, I feel like there should be a picture of me under that phrase just because it's very hard for me to like rock myself into movement. And I think, it took some very big signs back then. And I'm glad I was open to them. I'm glad I was young enough to feel like I could make those changes. I also had the support of my family, which, you know, not everybody's family is like, yeah, sure, transfer to Savannah College of Art. I mean, they had no problem with SCAD, but, you know, they did not like comic books. They did not think that was what I was going to be doing. I mean, they were very supportive and kind in the way that you need that to be, but they at no time were like, yeah, you should definitely try to be a comic book writer and artist. they never were like, yeah, do that. Like, they thought it was crazy.
Yeah.
But they were very supportive. They were like, if you want to transfer, we can do it and we'll figure it out. And I got a small scholarship, but you know, so I had a lot of other things working for me that helped me to do that. But in a weird way, and it's hard to know this in the moment, but looking back, it feels like even more important that I listened to my instincts and to what the world was telling me and be open to that, because I did have some people supporting me that would allow me to make that change, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, people live their whole lives somewhere that they don't like, and they're, you know, there are always these excuses for not leaving, but you know, sometimes you just got to do it. Sometimes your soul craves for something else, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, listen to that, because we, you know, you never know when you don't get a chance to do it. So, okay, let's see. I want to make sure to get to a couple things before, we run out of time today. As I mentioned earlier, in my humble opinion, Absolute Wonder Woman is the best thing happening in comic books right now. And this is coming from a guy that, like, I've never really read Wonder Woman just because I'm not really like a DC guy. And like, I read like small George Perez and part of Gail Simone's run and like, fine, but it was never a character that super spoke to me. So when Absolute, you know, the Absolute line was launched, I read them all, and not for any other reason, again, besides that Wonder Woman was not like on my radar as a character, did I anticipate this would be the book that I'm like, oh my God, this book is so good. And I mean, I've certainly read plenty of your stuff that I enjoyed. So it wasn't anything about the creative team. It was just, I assumed like, yeah, Wonder Woman. Okay. You know? Like, do you, are you like aware of what you're doing with this character? Like, I mean, like, in a sense where, like, are you aware of how good this book is and how well it's being received?
I think I'm a little bit aware. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of really incredible chatter, and it seems to happen in a very organic way. Like, sometimes, you know, especially with like your creator owned stuff, your indie stuff, you're just out there and you just feel like you're banging this drum and trying to get people to see a good thing you're making. And like, you get encouragement along the way. You know, people are great about, you know, letting you know or whatever, but it never seems to like pick up and carry on without you.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that that's the difference I feel on the Wonder Woman book, because it just feels like everyone's carrying it for, like, I don't even have to go out there and bang, because I just, if I go online, I just see someone going, oh my God, my friend just told me to read the first two issues of Absolute Wonder Woman and it's peak, man. And like, you're like, oh, well, that's great. Like, just this organic stuff happening. And like, it just is not really stopping so far, which is great. So it feels like it just has good word of mouth. And plus, I'm seeing people every day who are like, oh, I see everyone is talking about this, I'm not going to be able to get it till I get the trade. But like, I just realized the other day, like, there are tons of people who are going to read it in August or whatever it is when the trade comes out.
Yeah.
Who oh, yeah. have no idea, just because they only consume in a different form, right? So it feels really great. I want to believe that it's even bigger than you, like, I have the inkling of, because I don't really go to cons and do that kind of thing. But it definitely feels like a real moment. I think I don't want to say inadvertent, because you're always trying to tap into something powerful, but sure. It does seem like we tapped into something people really respond to in the character. And it means a lot to me. I mean, listen, I've cried writing basically every issue, so I'm clearly emotionally compromised at this
yeah.
point.
Well, I've been reading comic books for, I don't know, 35 years, and I couldn't tell you the amount of books and titles and things I've read, and to the point where, like, most things I've read over the last few years, I've just, like, reading out of habit, you know, because you're like just stuck in this. Well, I've read X-Men since I was 9, so I guess I just keep reading X-Men. You know,
time to read the next one.
Like, this was one of the first things in a long time that really hit me, where I'm like, oh my God, this is just everything about this. It's the take on her origin is innovative. Her relationship with Cersei is so the most interesting part, in my opinion. Like, you know, young Diana is just so just like this pureness about her. But in a way that's not like boring, like Superman, hey, I'm good, I always do good, I do good, and when I'm not doing good, I'm doing better, you know, type of thing. Like, there's like a real genuine feeling of like a person in there, you know?
Thank you. I think part of it, I mean, I think especially when you say the Superman thing, because I think a lot of the things we're doing with Diana, minus maybe the magic stuff, does feel, I mean, I think it feels Diana-y, but I can see the parallel to Cal, to Clark as well. And I think part of the reason it works better or differently here is simply the environment. So, like, there's a scene coming up with young Diana sort of training mm-hmm. when she's little in issue 10. I think it's in 10. It's in 10. The scene starts in 9, but it really, the meat of it's in 10. And it's so powerful to see this child, like, you know, and the way she's behaving. But her actions don't seem that different than if you ported in regular universe Diana or regular universe Clark, even, to me. But it's the context of the environment. It's the odds that are stacked against them and the darkness that sort of surrounds them.
Yeah.
I think it just allows them to shine even brighter. I think our Diana is a strange dichotomy. I think she's very similar to her other world counterpart in the ways that matter. I think, ironically, in some ways, our Diana is even more sort of kind and compassionate and maybe naive. But I also think she's a little bit more of a killer. Like, I think she kills way easier than Diana of the main universe. Now, is that going to change now that she's coming more up against more human sort of combatants? We'll see. I think those will be things she has to wrestle with. But, like, I just don't think there's a lot of indecision in her about, oh, I better do what's right. It's just like, I do what must be done. Like, that's
right.
More the drumbeat. But it's a tricky balance. And I think as we go along, I'm very excited about a lot of the things we have coming, but I do think those things get more complicated for her and for readers as we go, not less. You know, you start of this from this place of like this clear perception where you've got this character who was raised in hell and who's now going to be, but like the longer she's in man's world, I think the more muddy some of those things can be for her, and it's a challenge for her to, that's part of her challenge, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think the key word you said when you were describing it was the naivety, which is so interesting because, you know, there's a naivety in that can be powerful, but a naivety that can be negative as she does start to navigate the human world a little more, and how that, you know, naivety can be a crutch and something used against her also.
Yeah.
So, I have a question about her design that I'm hoping you can answer. I'm wondering if this was your something you had notes on, or something that the artist Hayden Sherman, or I'm not sure who's first designed this character. But I love the little touches that, like, she looks Greek, like even to the point of her nose is a little more defined. And like this, a little larger, a little sharper, like her facial features look like she's Greek. Like, was there something behind that? Is this just how it was drawn, or was there a conversation about it?
I don't remember specifically talking about like her nose specifically, which tends to be the thing that gets called out from people, but we definitely thought a more Greek look, a more Hellenistic vibe, yeah. Greco-Roman features would be great. Why not? I like it because it's a nod to where she comes from and a lot of great art and iconic imagery that works to her favor. So it only strengthens her tie to those things to do it. But I gotta be honest, it also just is more interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with beautiful women, and I think our Diana is beautiful, but, you know, I've seen enough little ski slope noses to sink a ship. Like, let's move. Like, there are different faces that are also beautiful, you know? I think I was, when we were first designing, Hayden is the designer. Hayden has designed almost everything so far. Mattia designed the Chimera in issue 7, and also the Prometheus. Mattia did the design for Prometheus in issue 6 and the Basilisk in issue 6. But like all the gods and all the world building and everything has been Hayden. They've been incredible. You know, we talked about her sort of, Hayden gave us eye types, and we picked like, we didn't pick the most extreme with like the makeup, but we went for a heavier makeup. Yeah. We went with the black lips. We went with curlier, sort of unruly hair. So, you know, and yeah, these more Hellenistic features. I think I was concerned when we were first talking about it. I'm like, I'm very interested in all this stuff, but I want us to keep in mind, like, we're not just building a book for us. Like, I think she has to stay pretty to a certain degree because that's sort of the expected thing for Diana. I was like, but I am fully into us exploring, like, what our version of beautiful is. Like, we can push on that. Let's do that. And I think it's worked pretty well overall.
I honestly, like, the design is, it's subtle, but also noticeable and striking. And I mean that in a good way. Like, when I first saw the design, I'm like, oh my God, like, this is really so unique and striking, as opposed to, like you said, just a, like, it's a girl face on a character, you know, like, you're like, you know.
You know, one of the things that's really highlighted what I love so much about it is, you know, because the Absolute books have been such incredible sellers, there's of course about 50 bazillion variant covers, mm-hmm. and some of them are very good and others of them are still quite good, but you're like, that just looks like a supermodel wearing Diana's outfit, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's great. Because I don't mean that it's great that it looks like a supermodel cosplaying as her, but I think it's sort of great that it's taking hold enough as a look within the culture and the belief about Wonder Woman that I'm seeing other people saying that. Like, there were some very pretty, like, quite good variant covers that I liked a lot. and that I was like, you know, I just wish she had the nose, or I wish it just looked a little more like her. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing people saying that online. Again, this is that thing where it just sort of organically is happening. Like, it's not something I'm talking about on my Substack or on my Blue Sky account. It's just something people are saying to each other as they talk about how she should look and how she should be portrayed. And I think that's interesting. And listen, if we've made enough of an impact that not only it impacts Wonder Woman, but it impacts like even more how other women are getting to be drawn in books and men too, that'd be great. I think, you know, the problem with this in comics is that it's really hard to ask this of artists because their jobs are just so freaking hard. I mean, to do the level of detail and the storytelling and the craftsmanship to pump out a book once a month is incredible amount of work. So to ask them to be like, hey, every face should look like a human and be distinctive and not, you know, you shouldn't take any shortcuts about these faces, like, it's just a huge ask. But it would be, I mean, it fills me with so much joy when I can see faces that feel more like the world, you know?
Yeah.
And not an Instagram party or something.
Yeah,
I don't know, like an Instagram influencer.
Everyone's using the same filter.
Everyone's using the same plastic surgeon here.
No, it really, I mean, I love the design. I love the look. It's very striking. She's still obviously very, very beautiful character. And just, it's really unique and interesting. And it's just something that struck me as when I started reading it. And I'm like, oh, they really like went out of their way to make this look like she should look. And still look great, you know. It's yeah. Really it was just a nice little touch that you don't always see in design work. So I shifting gears a little bit, I gotta ask you, because I mentioned this earlier, and also you started with X-Men was your intro into comic books. I'm a huge X-Men guy. That was my thing. You worked on the X-Men kind of, what did they call it, Reloaded? Was that the 2019?
Was that what it was called?
I think that's how they like marketed it. Reloaded 2019. That's the one I'm thinking of, right? That's the one you did.
I did Roving the Emmett miniseries. I did Mr. and Mrs. X, which was a ongoing series, but it only lasted 12 issues because it got cut off by the Krakoa stuff.
Yeah.
And then I co-wrote Uncanny X-Men with Matt Rosenberg and Ed Brisson. I don't remember that being called Reloaded. I guess it could have been.
Maybe
but that's not. But that was the thing that basically wrecked everything. Our directive was to come in and wreck everything so that the Krakoa era could come into fruition. And then they ended up having that thing between our stuff and Krakoa, where it was like the alternate reality stuff, sort of, which was ironically something I had pitched at the summit to do a new Age of Apocalypse thing, but I take no credit because that was not what I pitched.
Not what you pitched. Yeah, distance yourself from that.
Do not send me angry letters. Those were not the books I pitched.
It would have been much better.
I made the mistake of saying another Age of Apocalypse, and that is where we ended
that's
up.
That's what happened.
I was not, I mean, I was basically shut out of all the Krakoa stuff and everything after that. I don't really know why. I love doing the Gambit and Rogue stuff and the Mr. and Mrs. X stuff. I would have loved to have been a part of like all that Krakoa stuff. I thought it was super sci-fi forward and really interesting. I think one of my biggest concerns was just where do you go from there, which I think they're wrestling with now.
Yeah.
But they've made some really good books, and so I think that's all you can really do. But it's hard when you explode the world as big as some of the ideas in the Krakoa stuff did. It's hard to put those things back in the box.
Well,
it's tricky.
Not only that, but I think they kind of fell into a trap of like, just everything was just world building, and then there was never like, hey, what about the world we're living in? It was just like, what about this and this and this? And it was
just kept
growing instead of living in it and exploring it. It kind of became a little bit of a trap. But I want to ask, like, when you were writing that You know, how was the experience, you know, co-writing with two other people, and also, you know, knowing that this is like a basically a bridge to kill time until this next big thing?
I mean, it wasn't to kill time. I don't want to say that, because I mean, we were trying to make, you know, the most exciting,
sure,
fun read people could get.
But you knew it was
get,
finite,
but,
I mean. Like, you knew that, yeah.
It was hard to finally get the call to get to do Uncanny X-Men, which is a dream anyone would who writes comics would have.
Yeah.
And then to be like, hey, your job is to come in here and fuck everything. It was sort of a bit bittersweet. And I was very excited to work with Matt and Ed. They were two of my best friends in comics, and my only fear after I said yes was, oh my God, what if I was more worried about those relationships than anything else. I didn't think we would fuck it up and it wouldn't be good, but I was like, oh God, what if we hate working with each other and it like breaks these bonds? But it absolutely did not. It was trial by fire and we became even better friends. So that was great. It was really fun to write with them. I think we did it in an insane way that I probably would not, suggest doing with people I didn't know as well, like, but I do think it created a more cohesive story, and despite all the chaos, it holds together pretty well. And I think part of that is because we were each writing every issue. Like, we would break it up, seven, six for each issue.
Oh wow. Yeah,
when it was 20 pages. So whoever outlined it did six, and whoever didn't outline it did 7 pages, the other two. Funnily enough, because of the formula of comics, you know, which tends to be like X amount of, you know, talking heads, exposition, setups, things, and X amount of action pages and things like that, they all broke pretty easily, like pretty neatly into those categories. But it was a crazy way to write.
is there a reason that Marvel chose to have three writers doing this as opposed to just having one of you guys just take the job and do it?
I think it was because I don't know. I don't know what their thinking was. When I look at it, I imagine it's probably because they wanted it. It was called Disassembled, I think.
Maybe that's it. Maybe I'm thinking,
yeah. That's what it's called.
You're right. You're right. Yep.
I think it was because they wanted it to have the feel of an event. Like, this is a big event type thing we're doing, though it's only happening mostly through this one book. We want it to really, like, be big. And so, you know, I also think they, you know, when we went in for the planning session, like, you know, you don't do that on just a regular arc. They flew us all into New York and we did a weekend, you know, hashing it out or whatever.
Yeah.
Which was mostly Matt having 65,000 ideas, most of them good. Ed and I having good ideas, but only like three each. So there was, it was a lot of that collaboration, and they really wanted us to swing for the fences. I think I'm better at that now than I was then. I think I would have absolutely fallen on my face if I was trying to do that myself. I think Matt probably could have done it himself. He just thinks a little differently, a little bigger maybe. He's also such an expert of the Marvel Universe. I mean, I feel pretty well read with Marvel, but Matt's like on another level. I can't speak to whether, I feel like Ed's a little more like me, so I feel like he also maybe would have struggled, but maybe that's not fair to Ed. But Matt just has a completely different style. Like, if I'm doing a pitch for a book, I usually, I'll maybe bat around a few ideas, but by the time I'm actually sending it a pitch, it's one idea. And all, by the way, I've fallen in love with it, and I hope you do too, because like, there aren't other ideas at that point. but Matt is more like, I can give you 60 ideas today and 40 of them are good. You know, like it's just a completely different way for your brain to work.
Maybe it's like an old sales trick where, you know, you offer them, you know, you offer them three options because, you know, then they have options. If you only give them one, then it's a yes or no. But if you give them multiple, they're going to pick one.
Maybe, but in my experience, if you give them multiple options, they pick the one you don't like.
That's probably, yeah. Well, better to just not write the project. Be like, you know what? Maybe it's for someone else then.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I fall in love with my thing by the end. So I'm like, this is it. Like, you can buy it or not, and we can tweak it certainly, but that's what I'm interested in.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the best approach because, you know, then it means you are the most invested. And also, like, if you're so invested emotionally in everything in this project, it's going to become by nature better. I mean, I've written a lot of stuff over the years, comedy writing, all kinds of stuff. And when people like approach me to write, like people have approached me to write things, and I'm like, I gotta be honest with you, I don't care about that. Like, not because it, not because it's not important or to you. Like, I'm glad you, like, I'm not, it's not an indictment of this project. It's just that I don't have an emotional attachment to it. And that's not, so I don't care. Like, I hope you find someone who does, but I'm not going to do a service to this project. I'm not going to give it my best, you know, just by nature of the attachment I have to it.
I think there are advantages to my approach, but it would be crazy to not say there are also advantages to Matt's approach. I think he's much more flexible. I think he tends to be more creative. I think, you know, I'm very good at like finding the emotional through line and like pinpointing a thing within that, that I really care about and that I think I can make others care about. But like, I think Matt is just more flexible. I think you can give Matt almost anything and he can just Gumby himself into the position to do it. And I'm not like that. I'm like, come to me if you want this thing, you know, like a fighting book that has like an emotional through line, like that's what she does, you know? And so I think that's great. It's great to be able to be known for doing a thing very well. I'm not trying to downgrade that, but I also think there are probably huge advantages to being as flexible as Matt is, even just in the offers you get, you know.
Sure.
You know, the kind of things that might come to you. I had something that's not announced yet, which I cannot announce. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'll keep an eye out.
It's the most I've ever had a very specific take on something where I was like, listen, I'm dying to do this. I don't want you to think I don't want to do it. I am dying to do it. But this is the take. This is the really cool idea I have. And I understand it's complicated. I understand you might not like it and that's fine. But if, you know, that's it, that's the idea. So we'll see. We'll see on that one. I mean, it's happening or it's in process. So, it's in process at least. But, you know.
Is there like do you have any ETA of timeline on when? So like if something in, you know, 3 months that comes out from you, I should be like, okay, this is the thing she's talking about.
I hope it's going to be announced by fall. I think they wanted to announce in the summer, like in like around SDCC time, but they changed it. We've slowed it down, which I'm delighted by. But so I would think maybe an announcement in the fall would be what we'd be looking at. We'll see.
Well, I'll keep
Like, that's a great example of a way I would have completely fucked myself out of that job. Like, if they didn't like that take, I would have just walked away. And I think I would have been fine with that. But when I think about it the way Matt maybe would have approached it, you know, he'd definitely be doing that job because he's happy to do a lot of different takes. And I don't know. Again, I'm not saying my way is shit. I'm just saying I think there's probably real value in the way Matt does it, too.
Sure. I think both are needed for, you know. Well, speaking of like what you do specifically, you know, you're obviously what you've done a lot over the years is kind of solo female characters, you know, with Captain Marvel, with Wonder Woman, with Jessica Jones. I mean, that's probably what you've done. Is it fair to say predominantly in your career?
I do tend to turn solos into ensembles. sort of on purpose, sort of on accident, but yeah, it's mostly been female solos.
Do you feel like, I mean, was that, I mean, obviously you're great at it, so it makes sense why people would want you to do that for them, or why you would want to do that. It's something you excel at. But do you feel like at a certain point you're pigeonholed in that? Like maybe you're like, hey guys, I also want to write Daredevil, or like, not that no one's offered you something like that, but is that, do you feel like there's a level of that happening, you know, where you're just like, hey, you're great at this, so here's She-Hulk, you know, and you're like, what about Hulk or I mean,
yeah, I think it's a tricky question, and it's made trickier. I mean, I'm definitely pigeonholed 100%. I've only written one book really that isn't a female led book, which other than Jeff, I guess, which is its own separate thing, which is Deadpool. And I only, the pandemic killed it very early in the run. I got to do 10 issues. So, was that, and everything else has been either a female ensemble or a female solo.
Yeah.
Hawkeye, Jessica Jones, West Coast Avengers, I guess, was not technically a female solo, but it had more women than men on the team because that's what I do. So, you know, I think that it's some of it's just self-fulfilling. Mm. I like women.
Sure.
I like writing women. I like reading women. I naturally reach for female characters. If you lay a bunch of characters out and let me choose, odds are I'm going to pick a female character that's maybe less popular than Hulk or, you know, whatever. So when the world is pushing you toward that, and then that's also instinctively what you're reaching for, those are hard forces to buck, I think.
Sure.
It doesn't mean I don't want to do other stuff. I certainly don't like the idea of... you know, the female characters aren't as marquee, and thus it maybe holds my career back because I'm writing Jessica Jones instead of Captain America. You know, I don't know. That Daredevil, I think, is a really good answer. Like, you know, you can maybe become a much more famous comic book writer writing Daredevil, having a great run on Daredevil, than having a great run on Black Widow, even if you guys win an Eisner for it. You know what I mean? Like, it just...
Yeah.
So, but, you know... I don't know. It's tricky. It would be nice to have Absolute Wonder Woman and the popularity of It's Jeff having raised my profile enough that this isn't a question I have to worry about so much, and then I can just continue doing the things I'm interested in. But there are also benefits to picking characters with less worn territory, which I learned very early on. For example, I was writing A-Force. It was one of my first books at Marvel. I inherited it from G. Willow Wilson, who had some family stuff and had to step away. And when I was getting into my second arc, which was more my own plot and things I was trying to push, I was pitching for additional arcs, and I had this really cool idea for She-Hulk, which they have still not done. Which I guess I'm grateful for.
There's still time.
Maybe I can do it someday. But they basically came to me almost laughing. Like, they're like, this is great, but you can't do this in A-Force. Like, she has her own solo title. This is where that story would take place. And, you know, maybe that editor was wrong or short-sighted about that. I think that was early enough in my career where I just take what the editor says sort of as the word of God. So I was like, oh. But regardless of how right that editor was or wasn't, the truth is I discovered through that note that nobody cared what I did with Dazzler or Medusa or Nico Monroe. And so I had a lot of room to like throw elbows and tell some cool stories and make some cool moves. And that's true for Black Widow too, and it's true for a lot of these characters who are marquee characters but who still don't have the same number of stories or the same amount of attention on them. Or, you know, you can do a lot more with Black Widow, even though she's a character that's been around and done a lot. Well, she's a hard pick, but now let's stick with it. You can do a lot more with Black Widow in some ways than you can do with Daredevil, because look at these runs he's had over the years. I mean, they're just these seminal, incredible long runs that stand out, and she doesn't really have those. for a lot of reasons, a lot of different reasons over the years have led to that, but it means that there's a little more to mine there. You know, for example. So, I think it's a lot of things coming together to create that situation. I'd love it, as I said, if Absolute Wonder Woman and Jeff have sort of changed the situation for me a little bit so that that's less true.
Yeah.
But the truth is, you know, when G.I. Joe, when Skybound reached out to me about G.I. Joe, if I could have asked for any project, it would have been Scarlet. That would have been Scarlet would have been the number one thing I asked for.
That's fair.
Quickly followed by Snake Eyes, which I knew they wouldn't let me have.
Sure.
Not because I was a woman, but just because I knew that that would be a like big book.
Yeah.
That probably whoever was like running the universe would want to work in. So, what, you know, how can you blame people for pigeonholing you when it's also what you want,
yeah,
right? It's tricky. It's
yeah.
tricky.
It's not, yeah, it's a tough, it's like, no, I am, but it's also the hole I want to be in.
Yeah.
So,
exactly.
Yeah. Which, you know, it's so funny you talk about like how the lesser characters in this case are easier to kind of work with because, yeah, there's less oversight and stuff. But for me, I always love D-list characters, you know, not to call Black Widow or whatever D-list, but you know what I mean? Like the less, not like the premier characters because of that, because like, there is more interesting stuff. You can do more with them. And also that, like, people are always like, oh, that's a bad character. I'm like, no, these are not people with, like, fit characteristics. Like, there's bad writing,
yeah.
There's bad takes, and then
yeah.
There's, like, any character. I've always said, like, any character should be able to carry a series if a competent writer writes a good enough story for them. Like, it's just making it interesting, finding the right angle.
I mostly agree with that.
Yeah, you're like, listen, Dark Hawk is never gonna make it. I don't know.
It's a really hard market. It's a really hard market, even if you're Wolverine right now. You know, it's just a tough market. It's hard to get.
Yeah. The industry is in a weird place, but I mean, I feel like maybe the timing is bad, but for the most part, I mean, if someone writes something well enough, it's given an opportunity to breathe. I think there's a chance for it at least, you know. But you know, or maybe not a chance to make the book succeed, but a chance to make a good book. If that makes sense, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It may not get the eyes it deserves, but it was great.
Yes.
You know,
but I also think, one of the keys to that is, and we're getting pretty in the weeds here, so I'll exit after I say this, but, you know, part of the key to allowing characters to have really great stories that are redefining or transformative is not making them ongoings.
Mm.
Like, when you look at what Tom King, for example, was able to do with, you know, The Vision.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not a book that should go for 30 issues. That should be like an incredible story.
Right.
That lives within these pages and that has a beginning, middle, and end. And some doesn't mean nobody can tell a Vision story again. It just means this was that Vision of Vision, right?
Yeah.
And I think that I know people don't like the miniseries. I know retailers feel certain ways about it, and I understand that it feels insane to have something really successful and then be like, no, it ends at issue 5 or whatever. I get that, and I think there are ways somewhat to combat those things and try to work within those parameters, but I do think the limited series is truly one of the greatest pieces of comics, and we shouldn't be running from that so much. Stories that are intended to end within 6 issues or 12 issues,
yeah,
or whatever. I'd love to see more of that, because I think some of our best takes have been those stories that they beg for endings and, you know, infinite cliffhangers to get to the next issue, then sort of capped by something that feels like an ending only to then go into it again. I mean, it almost feels like insanity.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
To just keep going back to the well and keep making them reinvent things without reinventing them. It's a very tricky, it's the hardest part of this business. I mean, you know, I did Captain Marvel for 50 issues and it never got easy. There was never a point where I was like, just doing it, just open road ahead of us and here we go. It was like every 5 issues I was hard pitching the new arc and they'd be like, okay, now we get 5 more, and I'd go back in for more. Like, it's sort of a relentless mistress in that way. And I do think I understand why shops and publishers and even creators want long runs of things, but it isn't always the thing that's best for the stories or for the characters or even for the audience. So
yeah, I agree with you. You know, as much as it's nice to go back and have, you know, Spider-Man every month because you've been reading Spider-Man your entire life, like there's something like a, yeah, like a grandma's blanket to that, you know, and grandma's Afghan to that. Yeah. At the same time, those are rarely the best stories, you know, that because again, you're not really ever able to like close the loop on the emotional arc we've given this, you know. Yeah. It just has to kind of like keep stringing people along and you never really get to give a character a true, you know, some true pathos and arc.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think the limited thing is definitely has a lot of value to it. So with that said, how you absolute Wonder Woman, do you have it, not that you have to tell me an exact or anything, but do you have like a, I see this is the arc and then I'm...
No. I think Absolute Wonder Woman is one of the things I see the most open road on. And part of that is the success of it means that it's bought a lot of that open road.
Sure.
I also think you can't look at Absolute Wonder Woman in a vacuum because she is very much a part of a line of books and a world of books that are going to become, I mean, nobody's rushing the interlocking of them because I think everyone feels it's really important they stand on their own as their own things.
Which is very smart.
we will obviously see more interlocking as we go, as those characters cross paths with each other. So I think what the future of Absolute Wonder Woman looks like is not entirely up to me. It's hopefully partially up to me. But, you know, I think... doing Absolute Wonder Woman feels different. So I brought up Captain Marvel before, and one of the reasons I use that is because the same time that Captain Marvel was getting her 50-issue run, Al Ewing's Hulk was getting its 50-plus issue run. And while we were a modest hit that was getting approved arc to arc, they were like a runaway darling, and Al got cleared. They're like, yeah, you're going to 50 or whatever it was. Yeah. I don't know that it was 50, but they gave him a lot of runway because they're like, this book has such heat on it and it's made so much money that we've bought that runway. And so I would say Absolute Wonder Woman feels more like that for me than, which is the first time I've ever experienced that, where just nobody is stopping you. They want you to be building big and better and, you know, putting all your ideas there and not asking you to contain it to this, that, or the other.
Yeah.
And that is a great feeling. It's the first time I've personally ever had that, and it feels incredible. But I think that in this market, that's probably very rare and reserved for,
sure,
you know, the rare breakouts and the Spider-Mans and Batmans of it all that can just sort of have always run the table.
Yeah. Well, it's well-deserved, and the series is, like I said earlier, fantastic, best in the industry in my opinion right now. And I hope that, you know, DC's smart enough to just give you guys that kind of room to cook and just not start meddling, because like, the, you know, anytime something starts making money, they're like, how do we
I don't want to jinx it by saying this, but I'm going to anyway. They've been truly incredible. I've never experienced this kind of publishing oversight where not only does the editor totally get it and are advocating for you, it doesn't even really feel like Chris has to. It just feels like DC gets it.
Yeah.
DC just is like, we see what you're doing. Keep doing it.
Yeah.
Like,
well, it's working. What do you? Why would you get in the middle of it? Why would you?
We're not getting in your way. It's a beautiful thing. It's really nice. It's
fantastic. I love it. Thank you, Kelly. I know you got to run, so we will wrap this up for you. But again, I appreciate you being here. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Anywhere people can find you if they want to follow you on social media or anything?
I'm on Blue Sky. You can find me under my name, Kelly Thompson. I've also got a newsletter if you're interested. It does not go out too frequently, so don't worry. There's a free version which you can sign up for. It's 1979semifinalist.substack.com.
Perfect.
And I'm technically on Instagram, but barely
there. All right, well, guys, follow Kelly at Reader Works. She's a fantastic writer. If you're not reading Absolute Wonder Woman and you like comic books, even if you don't like comic books, you definitely should be. So check it out. As for me, guys, go to deescomedy.com. Check out everything going on across the network. We've got a lot of live shows coming up, live dates. I will be kicking off my summer tour in August all through the Northwest. Tickets are going fast to those shows, so check it out. And again, we just got a re-up on Killstand number 2, which is in the shop at inferno.earth, so you can get those also. And number 3 is coming in hot, so keep an eye out for that. Follow us on inferno.earth if you're not already for updates. We're leaking some behind the scenes pictures and what's going on in some pages, so check it out. All right, that's it, guys. We're going to get out of here for this week. For the Social Hour, I have been Deese, and for Kelly, thank you very much, everyone, and we will see you all next week.